One in five people in the world live in China. Our economic prosperity in large part at the moment depends on them. Chinese President Xi Jinping wants to lead in the reform of the global governance system. What does that mean? What does it promise or forebode? There's a new book called The World According to China by Dr. Elizabeth Economy. Elizabeth Economy is regarded as one of the leading experts on Asia in the English-speaking world. She's a senior fellow currently on leave at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and a former senior fellow for China Studies at the US Council on Foreign Relations. At the moment, she's a senior foreign advisor as well in the American Department of Commerce, but her opinions are her own, she makes clear at the front of the book. Her most recent previous book was The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. Politico magazine named her one of the 10 names that matter on China policy. Her writing has garnered many prestigious accolades and awards, and her articles and op-ed pieces on foreign policy have appeared in the Harvard Business Review, New York Times, Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. She's a frequent go-to guest on broadcast media in the United States. Dr. Elizabeth Economy, good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Quoting you, the world according to China, one which celebrates Chinese centrality as a geographic as well as political and economic construct, is one that leaves little room for the United States, its allies, and the values and norms they support. That kind of sets the general scene.
It does, about China's intentions and what it would mean to have China as sort of the global superpower. And, you know, does China just want to create a space that's safe for China, or is it really trying to transform the international system in ways that, you know, will reflect Chinese values and preferences? And, you know, is that fundamentally different from the world order and system that we see today? And the argument that I make, of course, is that, yes, in fact, it is radically different.
Yes, and I'll get into that. A couple of years ago, this isn't my insight, it's been noted a few times recently. A couple of years ago, China seemed on top of the world, or about to be. It had its Belt and Road up and running. It was shrugging off condemnation of its antics in the South China Sea. It had handled COVID. The WHO, this is in your book, the WHO was deferring to China. America was in distress with COVID. Now, China's in the grip of Omicron again. Supply chains are buckling. Could be that it has zero growth this year. It's starting perhaps to look more like a rigid autocracy than a nimble super player. Would that be fair?
I think, you know, on the surface, that is the way that it looks. I think you've characterized it correctly. But I think if you, even just a few years back, you're right. But if you looked a little bit more deeply at what was going on inside China, sort of the polarization that's occurred within China, if you looked at China's wolf warrior diplomacy and the impact that that was having globally, sort of the sort of very precipitous drop in popular opinion polls, when, you know, people around the world were asked, you know, what do you think about China? Do you trust Xi Jinping? Sort of record low ratings. There were signals that things were not all that they seemed.
Still broad brush. Will China, as the century progresses and was said to be the Chinese century, will it simply lose the demography war? Its population will shrink. India's won't for at least a few decades before it starts to turn. Growth will diminish. It will lack the wherewithal to keep buying favor with less developed countries. Again, you mention in your book shrinking investment already.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point, this issue of demographics. And it's one that the Chinese leadership, you know, interestingly, has tried to tackle without any success. As I'm sure you know, 2016, they moved away from the one-child policy that, you know, had been in place for decades to a two-child policy. Now they have a three-child policy, but they simply can't get women in China to have more children. Their working-age population has already peaked in 2012 and has been in steady decline. As their population continues to age, they have a number of provinces where the pension systems basically are entirely broken, and they don't have a good system, as we've seen, of healthcare, not one that's capable of managing certainly the pandemic that's underway. And their system for caring for the elderly is grossly underfunded. So there's a lot going on there that I think is problematic for them. Not to mention, I should say that, you know, having fewer young people means less innovation. They can't get a handle on this demographic problem. And frankly, a lot of demographers in China believe they will not.
And now you're looking at China on a global stage. You've already written about domestic policy in China in that last book. But one thing you wondered during all the talk a few years ago about the dying American empire and the rising Chinese one was whether China really is the country that will take over the mantle of premier superpower. So that's still in the balance.
Well, you know, my conclusion, frankly, after watching China, at least as it stands now, and, you know, a different leadership in China could behave radically different, could be prepared actually to assume the mantle at some point in the future. But as far as I can tell, based on China's behavior, what China is seeking really are the rights without the responsibilities of global leadership. So, you know, China wants to transform norms and values so that they reflect Chinese preferences, right? More authoritarian initiatives around things like internet governance, trying to cement them in international institutions like the United Nations. So China's trying to do that element of it. But when you look for the country to stand up and lead on climate change, for example, or look at China's behavior right now with regard to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, where, you know, it's not even willing to condemn this invasion, notwithstanding, you know, its constant talk about the primacy of sovereignty. You really never see China, frankly speaking, step up when there is an international crisis of any sort, migration or whatever it is, sort of, you know, refugee flows from the Middle East or from even from nearby Myanmar. You never see China step up to try to forge international agreement. And again, you know, when the United States under the previous President Donald Trump was withdrawing from all of these international, you know, organizations, withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord, withdrawing from the Iran nuclear agreement, withdrawing from the Human Rights Council, everybody was talking about China stepping into the place of the United States, and yet it never did.
You've mentioned Ukraine. How similar are Xi Jinping and Putin? Here's a hypothesis, not my own, but it's mercifully brief. They've both been in power for a long time. They both remember former glories. They have courted the West and possibly feel rebuffed. They are both, as the years go by, impatient to realize their visions of a better world order. They are perhaps both less in touch with that emerging order and both making missteps. Putin, of course, more obviously with awful consequences. Is there a similarity there?
Oh, I think absolutely there's a similarity. And I think another similarity is that both of them have a distrust of, you know, intellectual elites and really have gone down to the sort of mass populace to stoke a kind of base populism and nationalism as an important source of their legitimacy. So I think there's even yet another common characteristic. He's clearly signaled that reunification with Taiwan is, you know, one of the items at the top of his agenda, as he puts it, one of 14 must-do items essential to his narrative of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. And so it may be that, you know, Xi Jinping is just, he's waiting, he's watching, and perhaps taking away some lessons, I don't know, from what's transpiring right now. But it's entirely possible, it seems to me, that at some point in the not too distant future, Xi Jinping's missteps will look every bit as significant as those of Putin.
It's hard to imagine an invasion of Taiwan that wouldn't be followed by immense international consequences.
And the consequences, I think, are only growing. One of the really important changes that we've seen over the past several years in the international community has been an awakening among, I think, countries in Europe, but also other countries in Asia, most notably Japan and Australia, that their security, you know, is tied to what China is doing in the Indo-Pacific. And whether it's a sort of behavior in the South China Sea or the potential of an action against Taiwan, you now have more and more countries, I think, thinking beyond just their, you know, own narrower geographic boundaries to realize that what China is doing, what Russia has already done, is really to threaten very basic norms and understandings of the current international system.
The World According to China, Dr. Elizabeth Economy is with us. Is China progressive? Is it conservative? Is it revolutionary? What is it?
What an interesting question that is. Progressive, conservative, interesting ways, I suppose it's all of those things at different points in time. I mean, if I had to choose, one of the adjectives that you've just put forth that I think best describes it, I would certainly pick revolutionary. Maybe I'd call it transformative, but revolutionary is probably closest. And I think, it had its revolution in 1949. In some ways, Xi Jinping has ushered in his own revolution back to that Maoist model of a single authoritarian leader as opposed to a much more collective and consensus-based decision-making process. You have the really dramatic increase in the role of the Communist Party in Chinese society, in the Chinese economy. You have much less interest, I think, frankly, in engaging with the international community, with Western ideas, certainly. And you have, obviously, a much more ambitious foreign policy. Really, again, I think the transformative foreign policy. So if I had to pick the word, I would pick revolutionary.
Russia and China at the time of the Olympics, I think, said they had a rapprochement that is beyond an alliance. Do you think, or has China looked a bit aghast at Russian ineptitude and its savagery on the ground in Ukraine?
I think certainly we can see that there are people, there are intellectuals, probably there are some officials who are looking, as you say, aghast. There was a group of professors at Tsinghua University, one of China's most prestigious universities, who stood up and said we should rescind the honorary degree that we gave to President Putin. So I think, and again, there was a petition that was going around among academics calling for China to condemn the invasion. I think there's been a lot of chatter on social media within China. There's a real debate that's emerged around these issues. And what that to me signals, I said it's possible there are also officials who aren't very happy with this. When China wants to completely shut down a debate, it does. And what I think is possible is that there are officials in senior leadership that also don't agree with Xi Jinping's decision not to condemn Russia. So I think that there could be debate within the senior leadership and that they are allowing some of that to play out on the internet. That's just a hypothesis. I don't have any evidence, but I do think that when they want to close something off completely, they manage to do it. So and it hasn't happened.
You talk to Chinese thinkers, not that they would know the answer to this question, but do you think Xi Jinping would have had a heads up from Putin about the invasion of Ukraine?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that he had a heads up. We believe, I think, here in the United States, in any case, that Xi Jinping asked Putin to delay the invasion until after the Olympics. I think the other part of that, though, is that I think many people also believe that Xi Jinping did not realize that Putin was planning a full-scale invasion of Ukraine and thought that he would stop after just eastern Ukraine. So that there may have been an unpleasant surprise for Xi Jinping in terms of the scale of Putin's ambition. We don't know. Or I certainly don't know for sure. And I haven't, spoken with any Chinese scholars about this. It would be hard for them to, this would not be an easy issue for them to discuss publicly.
The World According to China. And Dr. Elizabeth Economy is with us. So Liz, does it work what China's trying to do in the world? And what is it trying to do? Does Chinese history illuminate any of this? How could it transform liberal norms and institutions?
For me, the way I envision this is kind of as a set of concentric circles, right, in terms of Xi Jinping's vision and his ambition. And, the first is really just redrawing the very map of China to include the territories that, he calls Chinese sovereign territory, like Taiwan and the South China Sea, and territory that is administered by India. There's territory in Bhutan that China has claimed. So I think that's one big sort of change that Xi Jinping wants. Beyond that, He wants the United States out as the dominant power in the Indo-Pacific, the dominant military power. And so one of the big changes he calls for is the end of the U.S.-led alliance system. He says, you know, alliances are a construct of the Cold War, that they're anti-China, they're anachronistic, which is why I think actually, you know, he and Putin said that they had this relationship that was beyond alliances, because to call it an alliance would mean that Xi Jinping was doing the very thing that he, you know, was always criticizing the United States for doing, which was to have an alliance. So I think that's sort of the second, you know, circle moving out from just the sovereignty. And then I think you get to the issue that you're asking about, really the norms and the values. And I think that starts with, in part, with the Belt and Road Initiative, you know, which began as just a hard infrastructure connectivity program, basically, you know, going to other countries and helping with their infrastructure development, ports and railroads and highways. Then it moved to a digital Silk Road. One way that China is changing things is by exporting, you know, its very development model. Another is by trying to use the digital Silk Road to transform norms. And so in addition to, you know, fiber optic cables and e-commerce and satellite systems, right, China exports its surveillance technology. It also, you know, works with countries that are interested in helping them learn how to do real-time censorship of the internet, to control social media, really to control civil society. So that's a kind of expression of how China wants to transform norms. A somewhat more subtle, I think, expression of this effort is, I'll just use one illustrative case, which is well-known here in the United States, of Daryl Morey, who was the manager of the NBA team, the Houston Rockets. And back in 2019, he tweeted, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." And as a result, the Chinese government, you know, stopped broadcasting the NBA games. They pulled all the Rockets merchandise off the store shelves. In some ways, this is not atypical behavior for China. This is, they use the market as a source of coercive leverage. But what was different this time was that CCTV, right, China Central Television, came out and said, issues related to social stability and sovereignty do not fall within the purview of free speech. This is really an extraordinary statement because what it's signaling is that China has the right to control, as it does at home, right? China has the right to control the speech of people outside the country using a platform, frankly, Twitter, that China doesn't even allow its own citizens to use. We see China now, you know, pushing to reform the way that, you know, human rights are categorized, right? Moving away from notions of individual rights to more state-centered rights, putting forth a new internet protocol, again, that prioritizes state control.
And does the Chinese way appeal, do you think, to authoritarian governments who want to hold on to power elsewhere in an epoch where power everywhere is seemingly being challenged?
Indeed. The wife of the head of president of Nigeria said, you know, if China can control 1.4 billion people on its internet, you know, we should be able to do, I can't remember the number, like 160 million, whatever, 180 million people. So yes, there's no doubt that some countries look at China enviously. How many leaders do you think really enjoy having free media, right, that's able to criticize them on a daily basis? I mean, how much nicer would it be to open the newspaper every morning and see only positive things being written about you? So yes, I think it definitely appeals to authoritarian leaders globally.
For people who've got a dim view of this, I mean, another hypothesis, is it almost like a PR machine operating to sell a brand of coffee, the taste of which a lot of the consumers might think bitter, but they're given discount coupons too attractive to turn down? Because China's buying its way into countries. It's using the wolf warrior diplomacy. In the absence of that old ad agency dictum that consumers have to love a brand for it to really succeed. I know it has succeeded. It's altered the approach of multinational corporations and so on towards Taiwan. They accede to the Chinese view of the world. But will money to be made out of China continue as a sufficient lever for China to triumph?
I think that's a really important question. You know, after 30, 40 years of an engagement approach where you know, business is actively encouraged to go to China and to take advantage of this large and growing market, where we believed that that type of engagement would also contribute to economic and political reform in China, to China becoming, you know, a pillar of the liberal international order over time. It's difficult then to say to companies, okay, we've changed our mind. Now you need to pull out of China and, you know, change your behavior. And instead, you should be investing in Vietnam and elsewhere. But that, in fact, is what the U.S. government has been doing. And to a certain extent, China itself has contributed to this process now. I think what's gone on in Xinjiang, right, with the, you know, detention of over, you know, a million Uyghur Muslims in labor and re-education camps, the crackdown on Hong Kong, certainly COVID, and the wolf warrior diplomacy, you know, very unattractive behavior that should have been an easy win for China, frankly, in that first year of COVID, because they were doing such a good job of containing the virus. I think all of these things are beginning to make CEOs think differently and to make certain countries think differently. Again, I think we've seen pretty close to a sea change in Europe over the past 5 years in terms of their approach to China, and also a toughening clearly in positions in Australia and Japan, and to some extent now in South Korea. I think things are changing in many of the large economies, large advanced democracies, moving away from China, moving away to some extent from the idea that the market trumps all, and there is really no price not worth paying to be able to engage with China.
Are we looking at this, though, through only one kind of lens? Because on the other hand, it's Shanghai Cooperation Organization, militarily, that coalescing of nations has had success. And as you say, more than half the world's population is under that aegis. But then again, you look at China versus India and wonder how good they all are really as friends.
Yeah, I mean, India, I'm sure that China rues the day that it invited India into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. I think the bigger question maybe is much of the rest of the world, you know, all those, the 140 countries that did condemn Russia for its invasion of Ukraine, and then look at China and think, well, what are you doing, right? What, why aren't you on the side of right? I think that really sent a bad message from China to many emerging economies. Another message here is when you do look at the 10 largest economies, 9 of them are democracies, right? So that does send a message about what model probably works best over time. And China is the one exception to that group of 10.
It's hard to gainsay what a couple of military scholars in Beijing told you, that China should be able to have just as many military bases around the world as the United States does, if you're Chinese. But at the same time, this attitude, shared by Russia and by the US with a degree of idealism not always lived up to, this notion of spheres of influence in the world has been the cause of so much grief over the years and centuries. I mean, Japan wanted a big sphere in the 1930s. Now China does as well. The British had their turn. It's that kind of thinking that has always prevailed in recent times.
Yes, you are right. So, I mean, obviously, might doesn't necessarily make right. And the fact that China desires a sphere of influence, I think, certainly doesn't mean that we want to grant it one. I think a difference today, to some extent, is that we can look around Southeast Asia, which is, of course, you know, Asia, which is, of course, the natural sphere of influence for China, and can look at all of those popular opinion polls and realize that while China might desire a sphere of influence in Asia, pretty much nobody else wants China to have a sphere of influence in Asia.
But we've had the wooing of Vanuatu and Fiji and the Solomon Islands and the Cook Islands, those kinds of initiatives out of China. So it still seems to have us here in its sights. I don't mean that militarily, of course, but we are Asian. This part of the Pacific, in its view, this side of the Pacific belongs to China.
where we leave a vacuum, where we leave an opening, I think China is prepared to step in. I think that is part of the challenge, in particular for democracies. We don't tend to have the same kind of, you know, 50-year vision of what it is that we want to accomplish, what we want to look like, what we want the world to look like. And China does. And we here in the United States, I can tell you now, talk a lot more about the Pacific Islands than we ever have before. And that is in large part due to China. But should it be, right? Should it not be that we were already thinking about these issues and thinking about how to do development better with them, to partner with them, how to help them more, not just waiting for China to scare us into it.
Belatedly awakened international altruism towards the Pacific. I see NATO wants New Zealand to come inside its tent regarding China. You've raised an important point earlier. Autocracy or oligarchy, authoritarian rule, comes with a vision, doesn't it, clearly, and a plan. You know, and the vision is compliant populations prospering as economies grow cooperatively with China or whomever calling the shots, depending on, you know, the nation, the nature of empires. Elimination of dissent, rejection these days of the increasing chaos within liberal democracies. Is that a fair summation? And is autocracy in the world possibly winning?
Oh, I mean, I think your summation is yeah, sure. I think that's a good summation of what China would like to see. But do I think autocracy is winning? I do not think autocracy is winning. I don't think autocracy will ever win completely, because I think in every autocracy, there are the seeds of destruction. And so I think there are restive populations. And even with China, I don't believe that the situation will last beyond Xi Jinping. I think, in fact, this is an incredible moment for the democracies of the world to step up. And I think they can seize the opening that China has provided by revealing, in many respects, the dark side of the Chinese regime. Again, you know, sort of 1, 2, 3 over the past few years with the crackdown on Hong Kong and the Xinjiang situation and COVID and now Russia. I think that sends a very clear message about the priorities of the Chinese leadership. And I don't really think those are priorities that are shared by many people globally.
Liz, they obviously see the dark sides of democracy. I mean, we prize democracy, but arguably satisfaction with our models of it is less. There's certainly more argument thanks to the digital age. And obviously they look at our efforts to accommodate more myriad voices now as, I don't know, akin to a Tower of Babel. And many science fiction novels have postulated futures which we think are dystopian, but at least they suppress unruliness. So deep down, is that what the Chinese think? I mean, you've hinted that actually the dream of many Western politicians without enough power to make the dream come true is, you know, they'd like to open the newspaper in the morning and see nothing but good news. So this notion of just let us rule and we'll look after you, just get on with your life and just don't criticize us too much, could that be catching on? I'm restating the question about democracy versus autocracy in a different way, I suppose, but is that a dangerous temptation?
So again, I think it's a dangerous temptation for leaders who have autocratic tendencies. But even in China, you know, China is, frankly, every bit as polarized as any democracy, even as you know, we saw the United States during the Trump administration. If you think about the polarization along ethnic lines, right, what's happening again in Xinjiang, in Tibet, and even Inner Mongolia, polarization along gender. I mean, there is more online hate speech against women in China than I think anybody, you know, could possibly imagine. I mean, the World Economic Forum does an assessment every year of women's access to the health system, education, the political system, and the economy. And during Xi Jinping's tenure, China has fallen from 69th to, I think, 107th in the world. What does that say about this, you know, incredible second largest economy in the world? And again, it speaks to that demographic issue that we talked about earlier and women's unwillingness to have more children. there's polarization, I think, between the creative and entrepreneurial class in China and the bureaucratic class, right? The crackdown that we saw in the tech sector. What happens if you are somebody whose job or whose life is about coloring outside the lines? There is no room for you. And there's a really excellent study that's come out of Stanford University that was based on interviews, survey research of urban populations in China. And what they found is that a significant percentage of sort of the urban middle class wanted the right to protest. They wanted the right to have free speech. They wanted private property. They wanted all those things that we thought engagement might yield. So again, just because you can't see the desires, the hopes, and the fears of the Chinese people because they are being repressed and suppressed doesn't mean that they're not there.
Two more things before we go. In New Scientist, China's building more than half of the world's new coal power plants. The Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air says everywhere outside China, plans for new coal-fired power plants have been scaled back dramatically. But, quote, Chinese firms have continued to announce new power stations powered by coal, and there's very clear government backing for that. Do Chinese companies, I know this is one of your areas of expertise, do they do environmental impact assessments? Does China want clean and green? I know it has some quite fancy and innovative clean and green initiatives, but does it want them absolutely not to interfere with the economy?
You have had Xi Jinping, you know, step up and talk about China as a climate leader, as a leader in clean energy. Of course, until very recently, they were exporting their coal-fired power plants through the Belt and Road Initiative, but that became, you know, there's a real international backlash against that. So it stopped doing that. But you're right, domestically, again, despite the fact that they've said they want to, you know, have their CO2 carbon dioxide emissions peak by 2030 and get to sort of carbon neutrality by 2060, they are. Xi Jinping just not that long ago said, yeah, we want to do the right thing, essentially said, not do the thing. But right now, the economy has to be our priority, and we are not going to sacrifice economic growth. And so he made a very clear decision that to put clean energy on the back burner as he was confronting, you know, a fairly significant slowdown in the Chinese economy. How long that's going to last, we don't know. Probably at least initially, there was a new commitment to environmental protection, and that came out of really sort of democratic protests within China for the leadership to do something about the environment that took place right as Xi Jinping came to power. And they felt compelled to do something. And I think, you know, for the first time, China actually did commit to improve its environment in a fairly significant way.
And to improve a lot of its people, the elevation of so many people into the middle class with more comfortable lives, surely that's germane.
Well, if we're talking about the pre-Xi Jinping period, then yes. You know, Xi Jinping made the claim that 80 million people, you know, over the past, since he came to power, have been lifted out of extreme poverty. What was interesting, though, was that Li Keqiang then announced not that long after that fact I gave earlier that 600 million people were still living on $150 a month, and that caused quite a firestorm in China. So yes, you're right. Over time, it's been a major accomplishment. But whether I would attribute much that's been very positive, really, for China under Xi Jinping, I suppose it's my own narrow lens. But I can't say that I think China's moved in the right direction over the past 10 years.
Just quickly, finally, so that notion of all that old Chinese dream of all under heaven, with the supposition that China can be at the center of that kind of great celestial conglomeration of nations in harmony, that doesn't look, in your view, like coming true.
I certainly don't see that coming true. Again, I think, you know, if we look across the board at many of the initiatives that China has launched, there's been a lot of pushback by countries. Again, you know, a lot of protests around Belt and Road projects. China wants the dissolution of the US-led alliance system. It got a new alliance, AUKUS, Australia, the UK, and the United States. So I think, you know, it's important to look at the ambition of China, the challenge that China poses. Yes, you know, China's successes as it is attempting to transform the international system, At the same time, sometimes we don't do a very good job of tracking, you know, what Xi Jinping says he wants, tracking those initiatives, and then seeing what actually materializes out of them. Because sometimes I think it's quite a bit less than what the ambition would suggest.
Good to talk with you, and thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.